This is the second session in my series, Do, Discern, and Act, which is a very shorthanded way of talking about some current emphases in ethics and in how we think about Christian ethics. And today is going to be a somewhat participatory session, probably even more so than yesterday, because we want to wrap our minds around the question, how have we been formed morally? And so I think part of that involves a little autobiographical kind of work. I'm going to share some things a little bit later and invite you to do some sharing in pairs, probably with somebody that you don't know that well. So if you came with a spouse, probably that will mean sharing with a person on the other side of you, or not with your best friend, but with someone else. Because I think the whole challenge today is to give some attention to what are those themes, those habits, those styles of life, those various messages that come to us through all kinds of ways that have shaped us as moral beings. And so before I get into that, it probably would be helpful just to say a few introductory words of what I mean by moral. Because I think moral is one of those words that gets thrown around a lot in our society today and gets applied to lots of different kinds of things and lots of different positions. Yesterday, in talking about the moral challenges of the society, what I tried to raise up is some of the ways in which incivility and self-interest and the predominance of that really are the moral challenge of our day, and talked about how the moral has to do with what is it that holds us together as a society. So it's not so much just individual acts, moralistic acts that I'm thinking of, but that sense of the whole and the moral fabric of our society. So, moral has to do with the shape and substance of our life together, of how we ought to live with and relate to one another. And by that phrase, moral formation, what I'm referring to are the various beliefs and symbols, the customs, the habits, the practices, which is the one theme you hear again and again this summer here at Holden, or the ethos, all those things together that undergird and shape who we are, our values, our priorities, how we live, and what we do. And so, increasingly in our day, and I think that's probably a characteristic of the 1990s in a way it wasn't, say, 30, 40 years ago, attention is being drawn to moral formation. How does that happen? How does that happen? Not in an individualistic way of, you know, somehow I, this autonomous human being, and how am I shaped, but how do our communities shape us with certain ethical sensitivities, or not shape us? And so many people today pointing to the need to take moral formation much more seriously than we perhaps did in a previous day when it was happening, but we could take it for granted. And today people are saying, hey, but where are those communities? Where are those relationships that are morally forming us and morally forming lots of other folks that maybe aren't in place in quite the way that they were before? So moral formation is the matrix out of which moral deliberation and moral and ethical action arise. What I'm saying is that in beginning at this point, we're recognizing that ethics has to do not just with what we do, you know, the rights and the wrongs, etc., but ethics has first first to do with who we are. It's not action that's kind of the lead-off word is when we think of what it means to think ethically today, but it's who we are. It's our being. It's how we've been shaped. It's what has made us the kind of human beings we are today. And how is that then reflected in how we view the world, how we view issues, so that when we bring up some kind of controversial issue in our society or in our congregations or in our work life, more often than not, people's initial reaction is related to those forces that have formed them morally. And unless we have a sense of some of what has formed us morally, it's hard to read one another. Especially in a society that's as diverse as ours is, in most of the settings where I would imagine many of us come from, you can't assume a kind of homogeneous, everyone having been formed in the same kind of way, at least across an intergenerational or a cross-cultural kind of matrix. By suggesting that we need to give attention to who we are, what I'm pointing to is a whole tradition in the study of ethics that has to do with virtue and character, with dispositions, with focusing on the moral agent. Who is it that's acting? And not simply, well, what are the rules or what is it that we're supposed to do? But how have we been shaped? Who are we? So, two presuppositions that I'd like to share with you, and then share with you a little bit about two strands that have morally formed me in my life. But first, the presuppositions. The first is that we are being formed morally throughout our lives. What that means is we need to pay attention to the people, the milieu, the events that affect us and that decisively shape how we see ourselves in relationship to others. And secondly, a recognition that we are pervasively shaped and morally formed by the communities that we've been a part of, by those social realities, both positively and negatively. I'm going to share with you two strands of my moral formation, one of which I recognize I spent a lot of my life kind of moving away from at times. And through our moral action, we in turn are able to affect those social realities. It's not just that we're somehow determined by those social realities, but as moral actors, as people who are created in God's image and redeemed and set forth to live out a faith that is active in serving the neighbor, which is a very quick-handed way or one way of talking about how Christian ethics flows forth. All of that, through those actions, we in turn shape those communities that we are part of. And that means when we think about our moral formation, it's not just a matter of thinking about, well, what were the rules we learned, although I'm going to make some at least veiled reference to some of those rules that I learned, but it's a matter of, you know, what are the particularities of that community. What was it? You know, the material culture of it, where people lived, what they valued, family, neighborhood, the environment, the wider community out of which we come, how our educational experiences, how culture, including the media, and how political institutions have affected our values. And also those experiences that we have that challenge, that clash with, and that cause us to kind of rethink some of those values that have formed who we are. And in the midst of that, in the midst of those, you know, the the smells, the touches, the feels, the memories, the remembrances of what it is that shaped us. In the midst of that, I think, is how we as faith communities can talk about how God is active, how grace is active in the midst of that, how somehow there was a weaving in and out, shaping who we are as moral beings today. Any questions, just in terms of some of those basic presuppositions or that kind of framework that I'm setting forth initially? I think a lot of that, I assume a lot of this is somewhat self-evident, but sometimes we need to raise up what feels self-evident for some reflection. Any comments or questions on what I've said thus far? Okay, let me just share with you two strands that I realize have been a part of my moral formation. There's probably a lot more than just two that I could point to. As you're listening to this, what I want you to keep in mind is that after I have finished sharing this, I want you to turn to someone you don't know that well, and that might mean turning around rather than just to the person next to you, and spend a few minutes sharing what you see as some of the strands that have especially shaped who you are and how you view the world. What has formed you morally? Well, I was raised in a fairly stable, fairly conservative, predominantly German, north central Wisconsin community by the name of Wausau. I know there's some other Wisconsinites here, so I'll mention that. A community that emphasized virtues such as loyalty to family and country, the importance of working hard, the importance of making something of yourself, being nice and polite toward others, respecting your elders, be thrifty, be prudent. A lot of these last messages are ones I got from my mother. My father died when I was 10, so I was essentially raised by my mother. And a few years ago, when we had to clean out her house and realize how much she had stashed away, that thrifty, prudent, every egg carton and every this and that that got saved. And, that was certainly part of my moral formation in ways that my husband is regularly reminding me of. I never throw anything away, because of course that was how I was formed. He wouldn't necessarily say that was a moral formation, but I think it is a part of how we see ourselves in the world and how we take care of what it is that we have. I was also told repeatedly, don't say or do things that will call attention to yourself. Be humble. Be self-effacing, but upstanding. Be someone that I, your mother, can be proud of. Just make sure that you don't be too proud. So very careful, a little bit of this, but not too much. And these virtues were reinforced by the congregation that I grew up in. A congregation that had, since my German immigrant great-grandfather, by coincidence, was the founding pastor of it in the mid-1800s. Since that time, it had enculturated many of the predominantly German farmers and lumberjacks and factory workers who had settled in that area seeking to become good Americans. In a sanctuary, in a church sanctuary, that to this day embodies a very large church building, that today embodies the awesome otherness of God's grandeur. Some of these thoughts I pulled together last month, having not been in my hometown for about 4 years, and it was like I had to go back and just tangibly feel and see those places that, in order to have refreshed in me a sense of, you know, the material culture that had shaped me and how, you know, that shapes our moral situation in the world. Sitting in that church every Sunday, I listened to sermons delivered from the sacred heights of a very high pulpit, which when I was ordained 24 years ago and then ended up preaching there, I mean, that was a pretty intimidating experience, partly because of those remembrances of how I had been formed from that pulpit. A pulpit where God's law regularly came forth from the rather stern voice of the preacher, who admonished us to fear God. Now, as a child, I wasn't quite sure what all that fear God meant. One thing I was pretty sure of, though, that it was somehow entwined with who that pastor was, and therefore, it wasn't just fear God, it was a fear of that pastor, too. There was no mistaking what God called us to be about, at least in a general sense, to be humble, to be penitent, to be steadfast, kind, respectful, conscientious. In other words, to be good church members, family members, neighbors, and citizens. And those became connected in lots of ways and lots of references in some of the sermons that at least I think I remember, or at least I've reconstructed them in that way. This virtue of patriotism was reinforced by the prominence that was given the American flag, which was probably more recognizable to many of the people in that congregation than almost any other symbol in a very expansive chancel area that was lavished with ornate gold-leaf Christian symbols. On Friday evenings, it was expected when communion would be celebrated on Sunday that we would stop by the church to, quote, announce to the pastor that we would receive communion on Sunday. A continued emphasis on being prepared and penitent in order to worthily receive the sacrament. Whether intended by the pastors or not, virtues such as these came through as being central in what it meant to be and to live out one's life as a Christian. Yes, this was a good Lutheran church, and justification by grace through faith was proclaimed and taught. But the importance, I'm now realizing in retrospect, the importance of virtuous habits or practices, especially those that were more or less compatible with Central American values of the day, is what tended to be reinforced in the people who were sitting in those pews. And in that sense, there was a lot of consistency in the moral formation that I received through that congregation and through the schools and through the civic institutions of the community. And in that sense, in contrast to this moral fragmentation that we talked about yesterday, there was some moral cohesiveness. There was a consistency in messages. So that's one somewhat consistent strand that shaped me. Let me share with you very briefly a second strand, and I'm not going to do my whole life history here, but I'll just take this for a little bit. Waking up to the wider social injustices of the day, particularly in the early 1960s, with a rising consciousness of racial injustices, questions being raised about the morality of the Vietnam War, And what, through church youth group or Luther League, became for me an increasing and very disturbed realization of how much poverty there was in this country and around the world. Through that involvement, I suddenly realized that some of my moral formation was shifting. I began to hear new biblical passages and theological and ethical emphases that I had not necessarily heard in the congregation of my upbringing. It may have been there, but again, it's not necessarily the predominant kind of thing that hit me. New ethical mandates became strong. The call to feed the hungry, to seek peace, to work for justice. And what I realized occurred for me for many years after that was, and especially right then when this kind of realization happened, why wasn't I reminded of all of this horrendous injustice in the world when I was growing up? I found myself filled with a kind of righteous indignation. An indignation that, why had I not been formed by those values and those same passions in my childhood upbringing in the church? And that indignation, I think, helped motivate me and led me in a number of directions, including after a summer of living in the inner city of Chicago and being exposed to urban racial injustice and uprisings, I came home and with a classmate, the next summer, we were going to raise the consciousness of this mostly white community about what was happening in our cities and in terms of the Black Power movement. We set up a Project Summer Hope, and I was cleaning out some files this summer and ran across some of this. It was this idealism. Oh, we were going to meet with the pastors, and we were going to get them organized, and we were going to. So we set up this booth at the fair. Well, believe me, nearly everyone in that community at the Marathon County Fair steered away from that booth. It was like, what is all this stuff about racial injustice? They weren't quite sure they wanted to touch what these two products of that community were trying to present to the community. Almost instinctively, as a college student, I sought out ever more expansive exposures and experiences that confronted me far more starkly with the injustices of the world in places like Africa and Asia, and returned all fired up to bring the impact of those experiences back home, again with a kind of moral outrage that was probably rather incomprehensible to not only my family but to that community in which I was raised. I share that second strand because certainly I see it as it's had a pivotal role in my own moral formation, including the early years of being one of the first women to go to Lutheran women to go to seminary and become a pastor. But it means that things like courage, virtues like courage, risk, going against the grain, more and more then became a part also of my moral formation, of who I was. And because of having been in certain places at certain times. So I think some of our moral formation comes through that kind of, day in, day out formation that happens in community. But at times, for many of us, it's those, it's that trip to Central America. It's that, perhaps at times coming here to Holden Village, in many ways from 1970 on, periodically coming to Holden has been one of those places where I think some of that continuing moral formation or trying to make sense of the discrepancy between these different forces that have impacted me, this is one of the places where that has occurred. So those are, I share that as a way of, I hope, provoking for you some reflections on what has shaped you morally. So I'd like you now to turn to a neighbor you don't know too well, and share with one another at least two strands that have shaped you morally in your life. Can we do that? And then we'll do a little bit of sharing and saying, now what does that make, you know, what are the implications of that as it shaped us, many of us who are beyond just young adulthood, and what does that mean in terms, and we'll talk about what that means for today when we come back. Okay, can we spend 10 to 15 minutes doing this in groups of two? If you want to do three, that's okay, but I think two by two makes it a little easier to have more conversation. You can turn off the tape recorder. After the session, part of what I like to do around Holden is start some conversations that I hope don't get finished in the hour, but that will continue beyond just that particular session. One of the reasons I want to hear from you now is I want to glean some wisdom of what you've been sharing with each other. I'm going to put some of these up on the board, either some phrases or maybe some question statements that arose for you as you were thinking that. But let's begin with trying to come up with some words or phrases to describe our moral formation as you shared it with one another.
Fussing.
Two S's, yes. Okay.
Do you have a darker
one again?
Let's see.
There must be one here.
Oh, that's hard. Now, does that have to do with the four-wheel vehicle or kissing?
Good point.
Or cleaning tables.
Yeah. Okay. Others.
You certainly can't get away from family, but I've realized talking that I've done a lot of sifting in my life. Keeping what was good and letting go of what I didn't want to keep.
Okay, sifting.
Self-sacrifice.
Self-sacrifice. Okay. Just keep mentioning them. I won't call on you.
In the process.
In the process, okay.
Tension between different parts of moral formation, different times, different strands or pieces.
Okay.
Overcoming fear.
Experiences.
Okay, can you make that a little more concrete? I'm not asking necessarily to share the whole experience,
no, but alcoholism. I went through alcoholism, marriage, and that sure changed.
Through tough experiences.
Differences.
You want to give an example?
In terms of living in a different country, or a lot of times we come from families that, you know, like my mother was Welsh and my father was Italian, so you get completely different views on things.
Okay.
We didn't discuss it, but mentors.
Mentors. Okay.
Independence and lack of trust.
independence. And lack of trust.
Professional expectations.
Others?
Time.
Time?
Yeah. How long you live?
Different eras.
So you're suggesting that there were some real differences in eras with...
Yeah, the one I talked to grew up in the Depression area and I grew up in Vietnam War.
Okay. Can you characterize what difference that makes?
No jobs, no money, and conflict over a lot of things.
As an example, is it an era of prosperity or of want?
And I think also what it means to be a good citizen. Setting an example for your own children, deciding what kind of parent you want to be.
Okay.
Would society be something?
Society. Say a little bit more. When is society?
Oh, sometimes. Well, society says this is okay, but morally, sometimes, you know, according to my moral standards and that, it's not okay, but society says it's okay.
So for some,
mm-hmm. they probably change their moral because society says it's okay. Or, you know, what I'm talking about.
So what is it that shaped your sense of what was moral that made it different from the society?
Oh, my family, the way I was brought up.
Okay.
I'm thinking, I'm thinking about sex.
Was very, at least different standards from what you were raised with, from what you perceive to be okay in the society today. Is that, so it's a time difference as well as which community.
Corporate responsibility and also community nurture, both have to do with institutions of the church.
Okay. Can you make that a little more concrete?
The obligations of belonging to an institution or organization.
Okay.
Demand certain kinds of behavior and will dictate certain kinds of worries.
So like professional expectations. I see a corporate.
So it's
well, by corporate I mean not a corporation, but community. And right. then also the flip side of that is the way in which a community can be nurturing and guides us, teaches us about nurturing as a part of nurture as a kind of a more
okay.
community nurture as a, that might go more than mentoring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other themes or other emphases that came up as you were sharing?
We didn't talk about it, but getting back to the lady's comment about the Vietnam era versus the Depression, things like imagination. The lady that grew up in the Depression remembers the radio, but the person that grew up Vietnam era grew up with the television. Mm-hmm. That gets us to the whole idea of what your mind can imagine. We've lost the concept of imagination by the media telling us what to expect, and that the whole idea of media, we could be here for hours talking about how the media gets us to the concept of morals.
Mm.
we should probably add technology to that too. I mean, just with the internet explosion and different kinds of things that's raised a whole lot of issue.
If I not looking at you, it's really hard to see who's talking with this light, so I have to stare into the darkness here. Okay, one or two more.
Something that kind of, there's a whole number of people kind of filtering through the church, either through, you know, direct face-to-face or through, you know, good books and that would to help to try and interpret what would Jesus do. So, you know, which is the current slogan right now that we wear on our wrists. But it's always a it's been a confusion on my part in some times, you know, difficult situations. What would Jesus do?
And so you're saying that was a kind of message that was part of your formation as well as continues to be a kind of guide for you.
That is correct, because we grew up with stories from Sunday school through the church. And like my spiritual father, Elvin Smith, you know, that was part of the beginnings there, and then also from my readings and from, you know, my pastor and my teaching Sunday school.
Any others? Yeah.
Well, I didn't talk about this either, but I think part of the whole spirit of moral formation has been the isms, you know, like feminism and and I guess I would put it under the broad heading of liberation because of the, you know, people who have grown in a lot of ways because of those movements
and the kind of transformation. I mean, there's a little bit of that in what I was trying to share there. Anything else?
Simplicity.
That was part of your upbringing or part of your current formation or?
No, formation, more of kind of getting away from materialism and striving for more and more.
Okay. A whole array of associations up there. I'm trying to trying to sift through and see if there's so many trends here. Lots of different messages, lots of different ways of putting that together. Did you talk at all about, did you begin to talk about how your formation was different from, say, what might be the case for 10-year-olds, 20-year-olds today? Or could we shift gears and talk about that? How is moral formation different for kids growing up today than it was for most of us when we were growing up?
I think in one way there's a lot more exposure to differences, or you know, to different cultural groups, and also to different ways of living. And the differences are not, I think that there was an emphasis, more of an emphasis, about blending in, and now the differences are kind of seen more as highlights of kind of a vibrancy.
Okay, so more of an emphasis on this.
Yeah, differences and uniqueness. Yeah.
I think that depends upon age. Some of us who have gone through quite a number of decades, we grew up in, as you were indicating, I think a very insular society and community, and what was right around us, our family, our church, our community. Now, we think of our grandchildren, the world is influencing to a greater extent, primarily, as this gentleman said, with the media, the incredible impact of media. Movies, the difference in movies from when we were growing up, and the way movies impact us. We're fortunately raised our children then rather than raise our grandchildren now. So I think we're talking about an entirely different impact.
And no matter how insular the community or how rural or whatever, you know, certainly being impacted by the same movies, at least by the time they get to videos. And a kind of homogenization, even though there's the greater diversity, at the same time, a kind of homogenization that goes on.
Profanity was unacceptable when I was growing up. If you go to movies, profanity is expected, totally acceptable. If you look at the media and what the movies are trying to transmit, and you think of that, junior high school kids using profanity in the school ground where you wouldn't have thought of it. Mm-hmm. So that's because of a greater community. I don't think the parents are that much different. Mm-hmm. I hope not.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, because I think that it was likewise the media that was the primary source for spreading racism and xenophobia. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think those are the same. Certainly it's different now than it was then, but I think those evils that we name from within culture, how the media has always played a strong role in that, and there are different media, and I'm not going to pretend that now is a less, a less volatile kind of event, but those same sort of things by the movies, the way movies are written and like that, and you can see the change through time of that same sort of
I brought up busing because there's a young man over there that has on a Ballard shirt, and I went to Lincoln, so he and I'll have to talk.
This is Ballard at Wallingford. You'll appreciate that.
Okay. The thing about busing, when I was bused as a high schooler, but now we're busing babies, and we're changing the whole makeup of the neighborhood because we're taking the kids right out of the neighborhood. Where even though I was bused as a 15-year-old, I still have my neighborhood all those years. And as I was telling Ione, all those women in the neighborhood could still nurture me. But now we're all out in the workforce. So we've lost that whole sense of community. But we're still busing the babies. And,
Yeah, you've touched on, I think, a lot of things that have shifted dramatically.
The whole idea of family, what that means.
Yeah, and who's there and who's there in the neighborhood regularly to look out to see what's happening to so-and-so. And I'm amazed at how much of that still goes, living in the South Side of Chicago, I'm amazed at how much of that still does go on in terms, despite all the obstacles of looking out for and again there's cultural variations here, but it's like, well, yeah, it does take a village to raise a child. And what does that mean when those ties within that village, within that community, are not there in the same way?
I think that younger people, I'm not as young as you were talking about, but I'm kind of on the edge, and I think that a difference that I know between my parents and I is this idea that expectations for the economic structure in the for the workforce that I participate in, and certainly the people who are younger than I am, that there isn't an expectation that we'll have the kind of prosperity or job opportunities, and we have to depend on each other more, and we have to lessen our expectations about what we will have and how much is enough and that kind of thing.
Although that, I would think, is still to some degree a countercultural kind of thing, that we will have to depend on each other more. Because I think there's also a very dominant strain saying, well, you've got to make it in this society and in this economy and nobody's going to help you, too.
I think two are playing at the same time,
No, I think there are actually, with respect to economic experience, there's fineness of layers that are laid down that are almost, they're very difficult to grasp because even for me, being raised in the 1960s, when I, as my moral formation was happening in my early adulthood, I lived in a time when having a job was just something that one expected. I mean, there was no expectation that one, if you would get around to doing that, to finding a job, and that it was not something to be protected. Now, in contrast to my grandfather's generation coming up through the Depression, he would not take a vacation. He worked 6 days a week at his job.
he would not take a vacation because he saw that all the people that did were let go. And that's how he worked through the depression.
And those pivotal experiences of seeing some let go can have a powerful effect on how one reacts to lots of different situations later.
And the point that I would like to get to, though, is that just the other day, I remember I was coming up in the elevator at my work, and I was talking with a peer of mine, an age peer. And we made some reference to how it was good to be busy because the alternative was bad. And I realized that that was coming out of the layoffs of the 1980s. Hmm. We were on the elevator with a young person who had experienced nothing but 6 years, say, of the most extraordinary economic performance that the economy has seen. Mm-hmm. And I just realized that that person would not understand that comment. Mm-hmm. That person absolutely couldn't understand that comment or fit it into the lens of their experience. Mm-hmm. So I just think that if I wanted to expand on the point, I think that our lenses, the lenses with which we look through the world or look at the world, there's a tremendous fineness that is more than generations.
Right.
Much more than generations.
And makes any kind of generalizations very difficult or dangerous.
You have up there number three, fear, overcoming fear. And what I heard from the gentleman's comment was fear. And fear of economic exposure or fear of loss of prestige or position. And that is something that is permeates our society, is the fear of loss. Mm-hmm. And the scripture, speaks against that. You know, don't worry about tomorrow, that we have enough trouble for today. And yet, most of us want to lay up much, much more than what we need because of the fear that we have of exposure. Mm-hmm.
One more comment, and then I want to.
I work in an urban high school, and I've been waiting for you to ask this question because since you started talking about civility, I work in a high school that is one third black, one third white, one third Asian, and it's our Pacific Islander. And this crosses all colors. This is kids who are, for whatever reason, they are guided by. I don't want to call it materialism, but maybe not an awareness or a concern about delayed gratification. Mm-hmm. The business community is equally at fault because they want them to work 20, 30, let's have them work 40 hours a week. What school, you know? Mm-hmm. Earn all this money and turn around and run down and buy those $95 Nikes. And it's very scary. The other thing I see too is this, someone alluded to language, the language that they use with each other. Gets worse and worse, and it's a fine line between joking around somebody being an mf'er and it turns suddenly becoming incendiary. Mm-hmm. And that causes clashes. So in that sense, I think civility, even though it's not what you talked about yesterday, has a role in expressing morality as to what to do about it or where it's coming from.
Well, and how we treat one another. Basic respect kind of issue. I mean, that's that kind of bottom line kind of moral sense. I think what I want us to recognize and what we want, those of you that will hopefully be back for some other sessions this week, what I want you to carry with you is this importance of recognizing how differently we have been shaped in our moral formation. I mean, there's some similarities, and that's what, and one of the reasons I like what you were saying about, you know, the different generations that you were and how they were impacted by the economic realities, is as we move within our congregations or in other settings to talk about ethical issues, and we're going to be doing a little bit more of this later in the week, I think more often what we miss and what makes it difficult for us to be communities of moral deliberation, you know, really sorting through what are the issues at stake, is when we move too quickly beyond those experiences and those strands that have really shaped who we are. And as we begin to try to talk about issues, we're haunted more often than not by those forces, you know, by the experience of the person who grew up in the Depression, or by the person who was shaped by the 60s, or shaped by affluence. And I think on almost any ethical issue that comes up today, unless we pay attention to what are some of those things that have shaped us, it's very hard for us to connect with one another. It was really intriguing how much head nodding there was going on, and I think some careful listening as we were talking with one another. And I think one of the central things of our being able to be more confident about talking about difficult ethical issues in our day is being able to have the ground prepared with that kind of listening, that sensing of the very different places that we're coming from, and allowing some space and some respect for that to be honored. And that's one of the reasons I wanted us to at least go through a little bit of exploring how some of this has shaped us, because how we react to issues is deeply affected by these dynamics. And unless we are aware of that, and unless we try to be as sensitive as we are to how differently others are affected by different dynamics, we can't communicate together. And it seems as though that kind of communication and grappling with issues in light of our faith is one of the central callings of our church today. I want to just conclude with a final question by an ethicist by the name of James Nelson. He wrote a book a number of years ago called Moral Nexus. Unfortunately, I didn't ask the bookstore to order, and I don't see it, but it was written about 25 years ago, and it's just been reissued because he's come to an awareness of how important moral formation is and all the ways in which communities shape us as moral beings. And his question that he poses in the book, and it's a haunting question that I want to leave you with, Do churches today have enough discipline, imagination, and texture to function as contexts and shapers of the moral life? It's a challenge for us who are part of Christian communities, especially in light of the pervasive effect of, you know, the market and all kind, and the media and all these other forces that have increasingly become the predominant shapers of what it is that we value. The challenge to the church to take very seriously its role in moral formation, I think, is a challenge that could not be more urgent or more important. So, thank you for coming, and we'll. I have my next session on Thursday, so hopefully we'll see some of you then.